Commission unanimously determined that this conduct warranted formal charges.
A Bethel judge is being investigated for misconduct. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Postal Service delays its decision on closing branches in Alaska and around the country.
It gives them a reprieve for a while, but it doesn't mean that we're not still going to proceed with our studies on those projects.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
A Bethel judge is once again under fire for inappropriate behavior. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
It's known as ex parte communications, and it's a big no-no in Alaska's judicial conduct code. It's when a judge communicates with just one side of a trial off record. Bethel District Judge Dennis Cummings is being investigated for such allegations for the second time. 2 years ago, he was suspended from the bench for 3 months without pay for passing notes in court to the prosecution. This time, charges allege that in June, Cummings told a prosecutor twice off record to look at an opinion that would help his case.
The commission unanimously determined at the conclusion of our investigation that this conduct warranted formal charges.
Marla Greenstein is the executive director of the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct, a 9-member agency which enforces the state's judicial conduct code. They filed a formal complaint against Cummings on December 9th. Cummings has 20 days to respond to the commission. The new complaint includes 2 charges. The first one details the most recent event when Cummings allegedly approached an assistant district attorney off record about a proceeding. According to the complaint, Cummings suggested that the Bethel attorney read recent opinions by the Court of Appeals as they were relevant to his litigation. Cummings allegedly did the same thing the following day. After reading the opinions, the attorney determined that they supported the state's position in the cases, which Cummings would be hearing later in June. If the charge is proven, Cummings' behavior went against the state's judicial conduct code. The second charge alleges that Cummings has engaged in a pattern of improper ex parte communications. It refers to Cummings' 2009 suspension by the Alaska Supreme Court. That stemmed from a trial in 2008 when Cummings passed a note to an Alaska state trooper which contained evidence about the trial. The next day in court, he passed a second note to the trooper and the prosecutor, which also contained trial evidence. The first investigation into Cummings took the commission a year to complete. This time, it took about 5 months. Greenstein says the latest allegations are less involved.
The last time it involved several witnesses and was much more complex situation. So this one's much more straightforward.
Because of that, she says their pretrial preparation should go quickly, which will be followed by a hearing by the commission. If the charges are proven, then the commission will send its recommendations to the Alaska Supreme Court, which will decide if there should be any disciplinary action taken. Greenstein says the commission's recommendations could range from a public reprimand all the way to removal from office. Cummings has been a judge in Bethel for over 5 years. Before the 2009 suspension, he had no prior disciplinary record. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
On Friday, the Alaska Supreme Court agreed with a lower court and upheld Alaska tribal government sovereignty. The attorney who argued the failed challenge says such tribal immunity doesn't legally exist. The case was brought by a contractor, Michael McCrary, against the Ivanoff Bay Village Tribe and its president, Ed Shangan. McCrary attempted to sue over disputed contract funds, and the Superior Court dismissed the suit based on the Ivanoff Bay Village Tribe's sovereign immunity. Federal, state, and tribal governments can claim sovereign immunity from lawsuits. McCrary appealed the sovereignty ruling, arguing that Ivanoff Bay Village is not really a federally recognized tribe. Heather Kendall Miller defended the tribe.
And the court rejected that. Said, look, we've got all of these cases from the federal courts affirming tribal recognition by the secretary. We have Congress, likewise, affirming that authority, and you've given us no basis for changing our views in John B. Baker that federal recognition of tribes in Alaska has occurred.
Kendall Miller says the John V. Baker decision from the Alaska Supreme Court in 1999 was the first that fully recognized the autonomy of tribal governments to manage issues with tribal members and affirmed government-to-government authority between tribes and the federal government. McCrary's attorney Don Mitchell thinks Alaska's high court got it wrong in John V. Baker and tried to use that decision in the McCrary lawsuit.
Obviously, it is not interested in revisiting the question of whether it got it right back in 1999.
Mitchell has long contended that Alaska tribes do not have legitimate federal recognition because in 1994, when Interior Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Ada Deer gave 229 tribes here recognition, he says she did not have the authority to do so. A year later, Congress passed the statute, the Federally Recognized Indian Tribe List Act. State Supreme Court justices referenced the List Act in the John V. Baker case when it affirmed tribal authority. Mitchell says because the actual statute passed a year after Alaska tribes were given federal recognition, it leaves that acknowledgement in question. He says the only way for what he considers legal gray area to be cleared up is for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide the legitimacy of federal recognition for Alaska tribal governments.
Or until such time as Congress passes a law that makes it absolutely clear that Congress believes that there should be 200 Indian tribes in Alaska, each of which has sovereign immunity. But until either of those things happen, either the U.S. Supreme Court rules or until Congress does something that is clear, I think that these kinds of situations will continue to present themselves in Alaska.
As it stands currently, however, tribal government legal status has been clearly upheld by the state Supreme Court in two decisions. Mr. McCrary has no other recourse in the state court system. His attorney, Don Mitchell, says there's been no discussion yet about whether to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision. Anchorage police continue to investigate the Sunday night shooting of a toddler who was sleeping in his bed when he was struck by a bullet fired in an adjacent condominium. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to Lieutenant Dave Parker, police department spokesman, around 10 o'clock, Ronald Flanagan, 26, was manipulating his handgun when he unintentionally discharged the weapon. The bullet passed through the shared wall into the next-door condominium and struck 2-year-old Ashton Chinnis in the head. The father, who's an Anchorage policeman, heard the sound of the gun and went into his son's bedroom. He discovered Ashton's injury.
He called immediately, but his police training kicked in, and he took care of Ashton's injuries until the police and medics arrived.
Parker said after firing the shot through the wall, Flanagan came out from his house.
I believe one of the people from Ashton's residence also went out. I think it was his mom. And when he found out that he had fired a shot that had injured a child, it really, he was just devastated by that.
Ashton was taken to a local hospital where a neurosurgeon operated on the injuries to his head. He remains in the intensive care unit, but Parker says the medical staff is guardedly optimistic about his recovery based on some signs of improvement. The investigation by APD detectives continues. After the investigation is completed, the detectives will present their recommendation to the district attorney. Parker didn't know how soon that might occur. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
A Fort Wainwright-based aviation unit that's returned to Fairbanks was one of the last to leave Iraq as the United States completes its pullout from the country. Squadron Commander Lieutenant Colonel Michael McCurry says the 440 soldiers who returned to post last week hold a place in history as the Iraq War comes to an end.
This squadron, 6th Squadron, 17th Cavalry, is the last air cavalry squadron in Iraq. We just left, and it's kind of a neat coincidence of history that our lineage for our unit flows from F Troop 17th Cavalry in Vietnam when they were the last ground cavalry unit to leave Vietnam. So nice little link there on the heritage side.
McCurry says no casualties were suffered as the aviation squadron employed 30 Kiowa helicopters to provide aerial reconnaissance and security in five operating locations across northern Iraq during the 10-month deployment. McCurry says during the last portion of the time in country, the squadron's mission shifted to transitioning facilities to Iraqis.
We transitioned the Mosul International Airport back over to the Iraqi Civil Aviation Authorities. So very rewarding to see that transition from a major combat operations through stability operations to now handing those locations back over to the organic and rightfully elected government of Iraq.
McCurry has served five deployments to Iraq, beginning with Operation Desert Storm, and has seen the complete arc of U.S. involvement in the country. McCurry will be relinquishing command of the Fort Wainwright Cavalry Unit in February, but says his work is not finished yet as he leads soldiers through a reintegration process on post.
All kinds of things from medical, legal, pay issues, all their personnel files. We're going through a full scrub of that to make sure they've gotten all their entitlements and all their awards and recognitions are up to date. And then we'll take a block leave period where they can, go home to lower 48 or if they have family here.
McCurry says the Aviation Cavalry Squadron's return home to Fort Wainwright will be officially marked with uncasing of the unit's flag at a ceremony in February. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, assessing the damage from the big fall storm to one of the main roads out of Nome.
Either the road is totally eroded so that there's no surface, or some of the riprap was also picked up and strewn about.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The U.S. Postal Service will delay the closure or consolidation of thousands of post offices around the country, including five in Alaska. The Postal Service announced a five-month reprieve this morning while Congress debates Postal Service legislation. The agency says it will lift the moratorium on May 15th. The Douglas Post Office is on the Alaska list, as well as the Anchorage Postal Store, postal stations at Elmendorf and Eielson Air Force Bases, and the post office at Fort Wainwright Military Base. Ernie Swanson, USPS spokesman for Washington State and Alaska, says those post offices are not yet out of the woods.
It gives them a reprieve for a while, but it doesn't mean that we're not still going to proceed with our studies on those projects and be ready to make a decision probably by the time the five-month period is over.
Several bills to help the financially strapped USPS are now before Congress. The Postal Service can't lobby Congress, and Swanson says none of them address all the issues,
including the pre-funding of retiree health benefits that costs us over $5 billion a year, the discontinuance of Saturday delivery. None of the proposed legislation that I'm aware of addresses all of the issues that we would like to see done.
Congress started requiring prepayment of benefits in 2006. Alaska U.S. Senator Mark Begich is among the senators taking credit for the moratorium. They met yesterday with U.S. Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe and Postal Service Board of Governors Chairman Thurgood Marshall Jr. to encourage the delay. The union that's trying to organize University of Alaska staff says that UAF's refusal to deliver some 1,200 letters to UAF staff is just the latest of several obstacles that the university has thrown in the path of the organizing effort. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Alaska State Employees Association Local 52 leaders say they're still waiting for university officials to explain why the UAF Mail Services Center won't deliver ASEA letters to staff at the Fairbanks campus. Local 52 business manager Sam Rhodes says there didn't seem to be a problem with mailrooms at UAA and other campuses around the state delivering the other half of the 2,400 letters that the union sent out last month to university staff statewide.
Over 1,200 of those that went to Fairbanks didn't make their intended destinations, but 1,100 of them across Alaska from Ketchikan to Kotzebue managed to make it to the mailboxes of the staff employees. So clearly the university has a very unusual way of distributing mail.
Rhodes says ASEA received more than 1,200 of those letters back on November 28th from UAF Mail Services, all stamped with return to sender, insufficient address. The letters contained an ASEA pitch on how Local 52 could help staff negotiate to limit health care cost increases and other union organizing information. University spokeswoman Kate Ripley says there's a simple explanation, and that is UAF's Mail Services Center is a contract postal station that operates under different regulations than those under which the mailrooms at the other campuses operate. The regs allow UAF Mail Services to refuse to deliver batches of mail that have different names and the same post office box number.
They did all have one P.O. box, so they weren't correctly addressed under the regs that govern post offices, and so they were sent back.
But Rhodes says postal officials he's talked with have told him that the letters are deliverable.
I don't know. I just can't buy that explanation at all.
Rhodes says he'd like to resubmit the letters, but hasn't heard any response to his complaints from the university. So Rhodes says Local 52 will include the incident as part of the union's unfair labor practices complaint against the university. The local filed the complaint in April with the Alaska Labor Relations Agency after the university imposed restrictions on union organizers. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The single biggest item on Governor Parnell's disaster declaration for the Bering Sea storm was damage to the Nome Council Highway. Of the $30 million in reported damages, the State Department of Transportation estimates $24 million will be needed to repair damage on the road from erosion and large debris. The 73-mile road heads east from Nome to the traditional seasonal camp at Council. Engineers are now preparing for emergency work next spring to open the road, followed by several construction seasons that will be needed to bring the road back to its pre-storm condition. Clark Milne is the DOT's Northern Region Maintenance Engineer. He says the serious damage begins around mile marker 22.
The next 7 miles beyond Safety Sound, at least 5 miles of that is totally obliterated. Some of the problems were that either the road is totally eroded so that there's no surface and the only things left is riprap, or some of the riprap, the smaller size of riprap, was also picked up and strewn about so that there's stuff scattered for 100 yards.
Repairs from the storm should be eligible for federal highway funding. Nothing has been finalized, but the DOT will be working with federal engineers to plan upcoming construction seasons for rebuilding the road and making improvements.
At least a couple, if not more, you know, 2, 3, 4 years before we're able to roll out and have the permanent repair project and have things so that it would be better protected from if we have a similar storm. And surely we will, within the next few years, have a similar storm. Because of that, we're hoping to coordinate with the FHWA and figure out if it's appropriate to have some betterments in the design to have it better protected for the next storm.
The governor declared a disaster last week for the Bering Sea storm. The state is now accepting applications for disaster assistance.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Outside forces like the European debt crisis and turmoil in the Middle East present both challenges and potential for Alaska's economy. That's the message Governor Sean Parnell had for the Juneau World Affairs Council yesterday in a speech reflecting on his first trip overseas as the state's top elected official. Parnell says he met business and government leaders on the trip who called Europe's debt crisis a potential global contagion. He pointed to the United Kingdom, where consumers buy more than $30 million in Alaska seafood every year.
They believe that if one of the countries in the EU defaults, cascading effect on the UK diminishes the value of their currency. That makes our seafood more expensive for them to buy, which means they will end up buying less of our seafood upon a default. That's just one example of how this translates back to Alaskans.
But the governor says there are also opportunities in Europe. Many Eurozone countries looking for a safe energy alternative to Middle East oil are thinking of buying liquefied natural gas from the shale-rich Lower 48. Parnell says that opens up other markets to Alaska's gas.
Kind of some interesting worldwide dynamics when it comes to gas, but what it all pointed to was that Europe is going to need natural gas, which has a cascading effect on where other countries get their gas, including the Pacific Rim.
Recently, Parnell has given more credence to the idea of an all-Alaska pipeline to Valdez, where a plant could make liquefied natural gas for export. But he also hasn't given up on the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act goal of a pipeline through Canada to the Lower 48. Parnell visited London, the Netherlands, Rome, and Israel on his overseas trip. He said the Israeli portion was paid for by the Israeli government. The governor's spokeswoman, Sharon Lehouse, says the state will pay for the rest. Norwegian Cruise Line says it will sail another ship in Alaska waters. Company officials recently announced plans to return the Norwegian Sun to Northern service 2 seasons from now. It last sailed here in 2009. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Norwegian Sun will sail from Vancouver to Whittier and back beginning in May of 2013. Northbound cruises will stop at Ketchikan, Juneau, Skagway, Glacier Bay, and the Hubbard Glacier near Yakutat. Southbound itineraries will be similar, adding Hoonah's Icy Strait Point and Tracy Arm between Juneau and Petersburg and skipping Glacier Bay. Crane Gladding of Norwegian Cruise Line says each week-long trip will carry about 2,000 passengers. That adds up to about 40,000 for the season.
We really feel like the time is right, and it really feels like with the cooperation of the government and the folks in Alaska that we've really seen a lot of improvement in the demand for the overall product.
He says better marketing and improvements in docks and shoreside facilities helped his company decide to return. So did a reduction in the voter-approved cruise ship passenger fee, which dropped from $50 to about $25 this past season. Governor Sean Parnell and the legislature credit that change for bringing more ships to the state. So does Ron Peck of the Alaska Travel Industry Association.
By reducing the liability on the head tax, I absolutely believe that had an impact on cruise executives' decisions, and that's great news for Alaska.
Industry critics disagree on the reason the Sun is leaving the Baltic Sea for Alaska. Chip Toma of Responsible Cruising in Alaska says international politics, not tax cuts, are bringing ships back to the state.
A lot of these ships from Alaska and from the Caribbean went on to Europe, thinking that they were going to do well in the Mediterranean, and of course the Arab Spring came, and that was just a debacle. So all those ships are coming back to this part of the world, and that's what I attribute all the interest in Alaska again.
Norwegian already sails 2 larger ships on round trips through the Inside Passage. The Sun sailed a similar route in 2009, its last Alaska season. Its new itinerary is one way, dropping passengers off or picking them up in Whittier, the nearest cruise port to Anchorage. John Binkley of the Alaska Cruise Association says that boosts passengers' economic impact.
Those people then will be getting on or off the cruise ship in south central Alaska. Many of them will travel then all the way up into the interior and other parts of Alaska and be spending more money and more time in Alaska.
Industry figures show cruise capacity peaked at just over 1 million passengers in 2007. It stayed about the same for 2 seasons, then dropped to about 880,000 for last and this year. Next season, Princess will add a 7th ship to its Alaska fleet, and Holland America is juggling vessels to carry more passengers. That will bring total cruise capacity up to about 950,000. The Norwegian Sun's 2013 edition raises passenger counts another 40,000, almost reaching the historic million cruiser high of the last decade. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Earlier this month, U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced $15 million to help American Indian and Alaska Native tribal governments invest in public transit. More than a million of that money will go to nine tribal organizations in Alaska. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Peter Rogoff is an administrator with the Federal Transit Administration. He says the money is intended to help improve access to employment centers and to promote economic development on tribal lands.
We have tribes and native villages that really have access issues for senior citizens to get to medical appointments, in addition to just getting to school or getting to work. So it's in part about economic development. It's also in part about meeting basic needs for members of the village who are putting a great strain on their family members or their neighbors to get them to where they need to go.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced the awards on December 1st. The FTA is providing grants in 25 states for 67 separate projects. In Alaska, the FTA awarded $1.14 million to tribal organizations. Projects will focus on maintaining existing transit operations during the economic downturn and enhancing services for seniors and people with disabilities. In addition, some grants will be used to plan or launch new bus, van, and commuter service in rural communities that have never been served by public transit before. Tribal organizations receiving the awards in Alaska include the Bristol Bay Native Association, the Native Village of Kobuk, the Noatak Public Transit Program, the Norvik Native Community of Alaska, the Gulkana Village, the Kinnick Tribal Council, the Sitka Tribe of Alaska, the Tetlin Village, and the Vanatai Village Council of Alaska. Rogoff says Alaska's geography means projects will take many forms.
Many of these villages are in roadless communities, and they have unique needs in terms of transporting people some very long distances. And that calls for a different mix of services and sometimes a different funding profile from run-of-the-mill transit services in the lower 48.
Rogoff says in rural Alaska, tribal organizations are considering traditional bus and shuttle transport, as well as creative solutions that could include taxi and air transport. Tribal organizations should begin receiving the funds in early 2012. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Rosemary Alexander, Ed Schoenfeld, and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Nome, and Daisha Eaton in Dillingham. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.